NUMAIR. Mary's got a natural gift for Twitter. I'm flagging it. I'm just handing it out like jelly
Thank
beans.
Thank you.
Check out Planned Parenthood of the Columbia Willamette.
Absolutely.
PlannedParenthood.org/Planned Parenthood Columbia Willamette. Stay tuned for political perspectives and have a great day.
Thank you.
There comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought will tell the world how you cast your vote.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 9 a.m. Coming up on Political Perspectives, host Gene Bradley speaks with renowned historian Ray Raphael about his latest book, The Spirit of 74, How the American Revolution Began. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre, followed at 10:15 with Flashpoints. At 11 on Intersections Radio, host Sarika Mehta speaks with two novelists, Celeste Ng, author of Everything I Never Told You, and Sarah Novich, author of Girl at War. At 11:30, we hear from Ashley Haight, Ruth Oliver, and Sarah Merck of the 9th Annual Siren Nation Festival of Women's Visual Arts, Spoken Arts, and Music. And thanks to all the KBOO members, yes, for your crucial support for KBOO Community Radio. If you are not a current member, you can remedy that oversight at kboo.fm. Just click where it says Donate Today.
Hello, you're listening to KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, 90.7 on your FM dial, kboo.fm on your computer. My name's Gene Bradley, and this is Political Perspectives. Our guest today is Ray Raphael, historian and author of 17 books. Since 2001, with the publication of his The People's History of the American Revolution, he has written extensively about topics concerned with the American Revolution. His work has been described as an ongoing attempt to rescue history from mythology and to give due credit to common people as significant historical agents. Today we're going to talk with him about his new book, The Spirit of 74, How the American Revolution Began. He co-wrote that with his wife, Marie Raphael, and it's published by The New Press. Ray, welcome to KBOO.
I'm pleased to be up there through the radio waves in Portland, where I used to live.
Oh, there you go. Well, you wrote this new book in collaboration with your wife, Marie Raphael, and as far as I can tell, that's the first time you've done a collaboration with her. What was that like, and did it change the process for you at all?
Yeah, the process of writing is great. I mean, we each took six chapters. We each wrote the first draft of six of the 13 chapters, and we each wrote first draft of one. And then we passed these drafts back and forth to each other maybe four or five times. She's an accomplished writer in her own right, mm-hmm. and so she has her voice, and I have my voice. And so the trick was how to blend those, and what comes out of it is really a fascinating process, and I think it's actually more finely honed, more finely crafted than my other books. And so, yeah, it was very productive. She actually did team up with me for one other book. I was in the middle of writing that Mr. President book for Knopf when I was approached to write the Complete Idiot's Guide to the Founding Fathers.
I saw that.
Yeah, and so, you know, the Idiot's Guide series, the Dummy series, I said, well, yeah, that'd be interesting, try to reach a broad audience. So, but I didn't have time to do it. So she says, tell you what, I'll help you with that. So we teamed up on that, and that was an easier job because we both had, they have a certain voice there in those Idiot's Guide and Dummy's book. It's supposed to be kind of colloquial and witty and very casual, and so we could both just assume a third voice and do that. But in this one, we had our own voices, and it was great. And it's I wouldn't advise it for every husband and wife team, but we've been married for 43 years, and we're both professionals, so it worked well for us.
Well, it was a really fine product. I didn't get the sense there were two different people writing. It was really a blended narrative, and it was really well done. You've written a number of books about the American Revolution. What made you want to write about this topic?
Well, I actually started my quest at the beginning with I was researching the kind of underreported communities of the Revolution, women and slaves, African Americans, common soldiers, you know, not just the big famous fathers and what happens within doors there. And so I wrote that book it turned out to be The People's History of the American Revolution, and Howard Zinn totally loved it, and so that started a People's History series. And with the New Press, so I had sort of some buy-in into the revolutionary period because I just really wanted to explore how common people reacted to those tumultuous times. But in that story, I uncovered in researching that, I looked into these things, casual references for crowd actions and rural unrest in Western Massachusetts. So you know, I'm interested in people's history. Well, what are those? Well, when I started looking deeper into them, it turned out they're not just crowd actions and rural unrest. What happened was the people of all of Massachusetts outside of Boston, that's 95% of the people lived outside of Boston, completely overturned British rule the year before Lexington and Concord. And, you know, that's just an amazing story. And how can that be? How come we don't all hear about that? This complete revolution before the revolution. And so I wrote one book about it, The First American Revolution, and that was well received in academic circles, but not that widely distributed. So Marie had the idea to take that basic story, that revolution before the revolution, and really write a full narrative instead of just kind of a story of this, you know, what happened here, here, and here, but tie it all together and show how, unless you know that revolution, which occurred between the Tea Party and Lexington and Concord, we're 16 months in there, and we don't really hear much about that, and unless you understand how and why the people of Western Massachusetts, or all of Massachusetts outside of Boston, totally overthrew British rule, you don't understand Lexington and Concord, you don't understand the Revolutionary War, and most of all, you don't understand the incredibly democratic processes that propelled that revolution forward. It was totally a revolution of the people, by the people, and for the people. No famous leaders, all decisions made in groups, basically participatory democracy at its finest the year before Lexington and Concord. That's the origins of the revolution.
Now these movements started in response to the British reaction to the dumping of tea in Boston Harbor in December of 1773.
So, you know, this story starts with the Boston Tea Party, and most texts most treatments of the revolution say after that, the British Parliament punished Boston by closing the port.
Right.
And they did that. And then they say, well, other colonies came to Boston's aid. That happened. And then all the colonies got together and formed a Continental Congress. That happened. And then that Congress petitioned the king in the hope that he would intervene and get Parliament to revoke the acts. And that happened. But then, how did all those things, people helping Boston and petitioning Congress, why did that leave General Gage and the British forces to attack Concord 16 months after the Boston Tea Party? And the missing link is that another one of those coercive acts, one that's usually just reduced to the fine print in our text, completely disenfranchised the citizenry of Massachusetts.
Can you talk about that a little bit? Yeah.
Yeah, not just temporarily. I mean, like the Boston Port Act, that could be revoked as soon as the people paid for the tea that was dumped. But this was a permanent and irrevocable change of the Massachusetts Charter of 1691. And under the old form, the people had a very strong say in all levels of government except the governorship. The governor was appointed by the crown, but all other appointments were subject to control of the people. The people met in their town meetings as often as they want. They said they dealt with any issues they wished to in the town meetings. They elected representatives. Those representatives formed the assembly, and the assembly chose the council. And the council was kind of the all-powerful governing body. It was the upper house of the legislature, and it was the cabinet, and it was the governor's council. And nothing could be done without it. If the governor wanted to call out troops, he would need the approval of the council. So the people had a say in all this, you know, directly and then through their representatives. But the Massachusetts Government Act, it totally wiped that all out just with a stroke of a pen. No more town meetings. No more town meetings. Couldn't even meet to discuss anything except they were allowed to have one a year to vote for a representative, but that representative had no longer had any power. And any other issues that they wanted to discuss or meetings they wanted to convene would have to get the consent of the royal governor. Of course, he would never give his consent to the kind of meetings they would have. Further, those council members who were always previously elected would be appointed directly by the crown. So all levels of appointments that they made, such as the sheriffs and the jurors and all that kind of stuff, and the full arm, all the executive arm of government, and government enforcement, that was all totally beyond the people's control. They no longer had any say in who those people were. So they could be dragged into a court by a sheriff who was just a crown appointment and tried by jurors over which they had no say who those jurors would be. So, you know, this was totally, totally unacceptable. I mean, how would you feel, folks in Portland listening to the radio, suddenly your constitution is yanked away? You can't vote for anybody. You have no more say in any decisions. And we can say now that our constitution is being eroded, but this is more than just eroded. This is totally legally, by the letter of the law, yanked away. So they did what I think most people would do. They rose up and rebelled, and they said, no way.
Now, the notice of this act was published in the Boston Gazette on June 6th of 1774, and you write that in an instant it altered the terms of political engagement. By July 25th, the Berkshire County Committee in correspondence was suggesting closing the county courts, which administer the county government. How do the county courts work?
There were two levels of county courts. There was there were two courts that were the county courts. First of all, they convened four times a year, right, on a regular schedule, and there was the Court of Common Pleas, which would hear appeals cases from the justices of the peace. In other words, your first level would be just go before, if you had a complaint with somebody or if the sheriff wanted to arrest somebody, take you before the justice of the peace, okay? And then there'd be a decision. Now, that could be appealed. That was the Court of Common Pleas. So that was kind of like the final say of local judicial authority. Then there was the Court of General Sessions, and this was composed of all the justices and the judges of the Court of Common Pleas. And this was the administrative arm of local government. It was kind of like the county government. And it did everything like determine, you know, the allocation of funds to the county, the roads, this and that. It was county government. So what happened is that rather than allow this, basically it was the farthest reach of British authority. I mean, this was all done according to British law, and, you know, Parliament was British law. So rather than allow those courts to convene, which were both the judicial and the executive arms of county government, the people said, no way. And the first court that was supposed to convene was in Berkshire County. So the Committee of Correspondence there wrote to the Boston Committee. Boston Committee was sort of like information central, even though, as you will see, the actual thrust of this revolution came from outside of Boston. People would communicate by sending things to Boston, and then Boston would send them out to the other towns. And so anyway, they said, hey, how about we close the courts? And the Boston leaders, who hadn't even thought of that for some reason, I mean, it's really strange. They just wanted to have another round of boycotts. But the people on the ground in Berkshire said, no, we want to just shut down the government. What do you think? And Boston leaders said, well, okay. So sure enough, first, when that county court was supposed to meet, the county courts were supposed to meet in Berkshire, 1,500 people convened and said, no way, you're not going to meet. They prevented it from happening.
Now, who made up these crowds? Who was in these crowds? What kind of people were they?
The first one was somewhat informal because it was kind of ad hoc and they didn't have that much time. So it was just everybody around. But then as they progressed, it came out, the next one was Springfield, and that was more highly organized and was basically militiamen. And by the time we come to Worcester, the third court to convene, we have well-organized militia units. Now, we're talking about in Worcester County, there were, it's a sprawling rural county, probably in Portland. You don't know the geography of Massachusetts, but Worcester is about 40 miles west of Boston. And it's and the county stretches from the New Hampshire county line down to the Rhode Island county line. So it's, it's a large rural county. And in that county, it was populated by farmers in these small villages and townships. So 37 of these townships, which is almost all the townships within Worcester County, sent companies of militiamen to the county seat at Worcester. And we actually know, because there was a diarist who actually recorded the head count, and we know how many people from each of these townships, how many militiamen came and converged on the town of Worcester. And it turns out it was 4,622 militiamen come into town on one day. Now, I did some calculations, and that turns out to be one half of the entire adult male population in this sprawling rural county show up on one day to close the courts, well organized in these 37 militia units, and they came to do business, and they did. They closed those courts.
Now, previous to this, town meetings were restricted. Attendance was restricted at town meetings to those who held property. But in this large-scale response to the British actions, people of all sorts were participating and had a voice. There was the sense of the body of the people. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, now we will talk about the body of the people, and we have to distinguish between Boston, which is what most of the writing is about, and the townships, and which were out all the places outside of Boston. In Boston, holding property was not a universal deal. There were all sorts of people who didn't hold property. You know, sailors and apprentices and the trades, it was more of an urban population, more specialization, and you had a large kind of like urban, you know, what in later years would be called the proletariat, and these were people who were not necessarily property owners. Now, initially, the technical town meeting was for property owners, but in Boston, they expanded the town meeting to they called it the body. And the body or the body of the people, and everybody was allowed to attend, and many did attend. So these things became huge and involved way more people than actually owned property. Now, in the towns, things were different because almost all the families did own property. There were very few. There were few who were they called the strolling poor, who had been dispossessed of their property because there was no primogenitor. So through the generations, and this was, Massachusetts had been settled for 150 years, through the generations, the land holdings were less and less. So some of the farms got just too small to be operative, so there was increasingly poverty. But still, about 85 or 90% of the people in the towns owned property. And when I say people, I'm talking about families, because only the men were legally owners, but they were supposed to represent their family. And actually in Worcester, it's kind of interesting because they had this thing then called couverture. I don't know if you folks know about that, but couverture is where the women are not allowed, married women do not own property. They I mean, their property is kind of administered through their husbands. Of course, it's in a sense technically theirs because they can, if they've inherited it, it can pass to their descendants. But it's administered through the husbands. But if the husband dies, then that property is the property of the widow. And those are the only people who could own property. And so the town roles of people who have a voice in the town meeting include that of women, of widows.
Interesting.
But it's unclear whether they, you know, in the culture of the times, it's unclear whether the widows actually cast out those votes or whether maybe their son did or something like that.
Yeah.
We just don't know that. But the main thing is in the towns, it really was more of a you know, they weren't as diverse as Boston. And pretty much everybody participated in these events.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio. I'm Gene Bradley, and this is Political Perspectives. Our guest today is Ray Raphael, talking about his new book, The Spirit of 74. You also make a distinction between the sort of the old order of people represented by families like the Chandler family of Hampshire and an emerging order represented by somebody like Timothy Bigelow of Worcester. Could you talk about those, what was going on at that time?
Now, let's go back to colonial times, and you're in this small town out in the boonies, and you're supposed to send your you need some representation in the provincial legislature. So who are you going to send? You're going to send your popular local, you know, blacksmith over there? No, you're going to send the one or two guys in town who happen to have been born to good standing and who attended Harvard and who often were trained in the legal profession and or who had great mercantile contacts and were actually the traders, because these are the ones that could talk the language of the the language of what was going to be going on in Boston and could wheel and deal, presumably on your behalf. So you had this kind of upper crust that traditionally had represented the towns. But, of course, that upper crust has more of a vested interest in the status quo. So when things start getting shaken up in the Revolution, their interests are no longer coinciding with the people they're representing. And so you have in one town after the other, these people are basically turned out of office, and people more representative of the mass of people come in and take their place, such as I feature we feature this fellow Timothy Bigelow. He's a blacksmith, you know, and people respect what he does, and everybody gathers at the blacksmith's, you know, because everybody has business with a blacksmith in those days. So they gather around his place and talk politics, and he's very well versed in politics, and he becomes the people's representative. Now, he was not the leader in the usual case that we think of the leader as some guy who is kind of like up there haranguing the people, you know, hey, if you kind of like, you know, giving the big speeches, and then everybody gives their huzzah. That's the way they did it in Boston, but in the towns it's different. Like in Worcester. In Worcester, when half the adult male population shows up on that day to unseat British authority, how are they going to do it? They have to figure. They want to dramatize this somehow, but how are they going to do it? So first of all, they need the judges to recant, resign, and say, okay, we're not going to hold court. We're not going to enforce this act. But what's the wording of that? So they elect each of those 37 companies. They've already elected a military leader, a captain. Now they elect a political representative. And those 37 people come and meet with the 25 crown-appointed officials inside this tavern, because they wouldn't let them in the courthouse because, of course, the Patriots, you know, occupied the courthouse. And they iron out some kind of agreement, but it's not final because the people haven't approved it. So they take it out to the 37 companies, pass it around, and the 37 companies, and so everybody gets to see it, and the word comes back, not good enough. You have to be stronger in your recantation. And so it goes back to the drawing board. So, you know, it's participatory democracy. It takes time. It's cumbersome. And even though they knew these guys were going to resign, it took them until late in the afternoon to decide how. and what they'd say. And then finally, at the end of the day, each one comes out of the one by one out of the tavern, and in between the militiamen line up on both sides of Main Street, and each of the court officials takes his hat off and places it in his hand, signifying deference, and starts saying his recantation. I will no longer enforce this unjust, unconstitutional, terrible act of Parliament, et cetera, et cetera. And so, well, some people can hear, but this is the old days. There's no loudspeakers, no, microphone. Not everybody can. So he has to move on in the line again. And so each one of these guys, hat in hand, has to repeat his recantation 30 times or more as they go through the line. And the people have humiliated the court officials and have taken control. And that was the end of British authority. And I want to point out, this is all done the year before Lexington and Concord. Not a shot was fired, and it was the complete overthrow of British rule in Massachusetts by a democratically constituted popular movement with nearly universal support.
Now, this popular movement eventually establishes a provisional Congress, and that relates to the Continental Congress that's formed later on. How do they keep that together? How do they keep that from just spinning off in different directions?
Here's the interesting politics of the day. First of all, with British rule gone, what do you do next? Well, the committees of correspondence, which are actually an arm of the town meetings, and they've come together in county conventions, and they're the ones who kind of stage. They're kind of the political act. The militia is kind of the military arm of it to enforce it. But the political organization is done through these committees. And they come together and form a provincial Congress, which is all basically, from all the committees, they decide we need to coordinate all this. So that's going to take the place of the old assembly. Now, if some of these people have just overturned British rule and they're pumped up, like in Plymouth, people are so excited after closing the courts that they all gather around Plymouth Rock and try to lift it up to the courthouse. But then this is a direct quote from the guy who reported it. He says, "But finding it to weigh 10 tons at least, they left it where it was."
Good choice.
And so, but that's how pumped up they were. And some of them actually went all the way, like in that town of Worcester, they actually declared independence. They said they issued a town. They say it's time to form a new and independent government, all dependent on the suffrages of the people. In other words, no parliament, no crown, because those were not elected by the people. And this is 21 months before the Declaration of Independence. They're ready to declare independence. And they also, some of them, want to actually invade Boston. The British troops are garrisoned in Boston, and they figure before the British can send reinforcements to try to put down our rebellion, we should just get rid of them right now. But then, simultaneously, there's this Continental Congress meeting in Philadelphia. And that's where the famous leaders are, Boston's John Adams and Samuel Adams, and they're meeting with leaders from other colonies. And John and Samuel Adams get word from the people back home that the radicals have not only thrown off British rule, but they were ready to actually declare independence and march on Boston. They get really scared, and they start writing back to their friends back in Massachusetts saying, please try to slow those country hotheads down. They're going to destroy the whole thing because the rest of the colonies are not ready for this. They're not ready to do this yet. So we can't, if we start the war, they don't want to be dragged into it. On the other hand, they understand that we are in the right and that we should not obey that Massachusetts Government Act, but they don't want us to start a war, and they don't think we are ready to declare independence because that would remove all hope of reconciliation. So you've got these two wings, the radical wing wanting to really do it right then and there, and the moderate wing saying, no, slow down, because you don't want to scare off our potential allies. anybody in your audience who's familiar with popular movements or, you know, any kind of progressive or any kind of movement, you know that there's always this tension between kind of the radical forefront of the movement and the moderates who are looking to the longer picture and trying to make sure that they get the maximum number of allies. Very constant dynamic, and that was happening during the revolution time. And it's important to know that they actually, as differing as they were in their approaches, they kind of came to a sort of compromise, which is what we will do is we will not start the wall, or we won't yet declare independence, but we will act as if we are independent in our provincial Congress. We'll collect taxes. We'll do all that kind of stuff. We'll prepare, and they actually prepared an army of 15,000 for an army of 15,000. But we will definitely not start the war. That was kind of the deal that was struck. And so, the radicals and the moderates, they kind of, despite their differences, they managed to work together. And I think that's a great lesson for our time in our movements. Both radical and moderate voices need to be heard within movements, and they have to figure out ways to keep the vanguard moving forward, but not to get so far ahead of the curve that it's just going to self-destruct and basically lose all support.
Now, in this case, April 19th, 1775, Lexington and Concord, there's no turning back. And you state that the Massachusetts Revolution of 1774 did not join the American Revolution. It was at the very heart of colonial rebellion. It evolved into the American Revolution. The 13 colonies, the Continental Congress, after Lexington, there was nowhere else to go. Is that true?
Yeah, exactly. See, what happened is because they had refrained from attacking first, when the British did make that first strike on Lexington and Concord, then they were able to say, okay, we fulfilled our end of the bargain.
Right.
Sure enough, once the British are actually marching on colonials, then the other colonies say, okay, this is true. But that army that they had gotten together, you know, of 15,000, and it was ready. I mean, Paul Revere didn't wake anybody up. You know, these guys are so ready, you can't believe it. The second half of our book chronicles how that's done.
The Minute
Men.
So,
you know, that's the subtitle, How the American Revolution Began. The first part of that is the spirit of 74, which is the revolution I've been discussing. The second part of it is defending, working to preparing to defend that revolution from a military counterattack, which did happen at Lexington and Concord. But that was the revolution, and it was in full force. And only the key date here, by the way, that's in no textbook and should be in all textbooks, is June 9th, 1775, because that is when the Continental Congress has actually. Prior to that, a few weeks earlier, the Massachusetts Provincial Congress said, since this is a fight for all of America, could you guys please take over the army because it's beyond our scope? And it was. I mean, why is the Massachusetts Provincial Congress running an army, you know, with people from all over the... So on June 9, 1775, the Continental Congress says, yes, we will take over, and that's when the Massachusetts provincial army, and then which had evolved into the New England army, turns into the Continental Army. You've all heard of that, Continental Army. Continental Army gets its new commander, George Washington. So that's the story we know, and that starts on June 9, 1775, when the Massachusetts Revolution literally becomes the American Revolution.
That's great. It's been said that you want our understanding of revolutionary America to be based on evidence, not ideological convenience. It's been 240-some years since the events that you talk about in this book. What essential lessons do you draw from that, and do you want your reader to understand about the nature of America and its revolution?
Well, there were really two lessons. The first is we have so underestimated the popular movement aspect of the American Revolution. All this talk about the founding fathers, this and that, and all these great individuals who sacrificed and everything. Hey, come on, listen, this was a people who was involved in this. Now, colony by colony, they were different. The revolution was very different in Virginia, where a lot of the, quote, revolutionaries were elite slave owners. But in Massachusetts, which was the genesis of the actual fighting of the war, it was very much of a popular movement, very, very akin to our civil rights movements or the movements of today, and it enjoyed universal support. And I think we need to figure out how such a democratic movement can be so successful. That's the first thing. And the second lesson I learned that we need to draw is, what is it about the nature of how we tell history that keeps such stories from being prominent? Why do we still talk about just these few heroic individuals and somehow think that they represent or stand for an entire people? We have been imbued by our history training to think from the top down, and this prohibits our thinking seriously about social movements and the efficacy of social movements.
Ray, I want to thank you for talking to us today. We've been talking to Ray Raphael about his new book, The Spirit of 74, How the American Revolution Began, written by Ray Raphael and Marie Raphael, published by the New Press. This is Gene Bradley for KABU. Ray, thanks very much for joining us. This is a really great book and very thought-provoking in these times of ours. So thanks again.
Thank you, Gene, for being willing to hear me out.
Well, my pleasure. Thanks.
Okay.
And that was Gene Bradley speaking with Ray Raphael on Political Perspectives on KBOO Portland. We have this late-breaking news announcement. President Obama today announced that he has rejected the request from TransCanada to build the Keystone XL oil pipeline, thus dashing their hopes of withdrawing their application and presenting it later to a potentially more friendly administration later on. Bill McKibben, co-founder of 350.org, had this reaction. Quote, President Obama is the first world leader to reject a project because of its effect on the climate. That gives him new stature as an environmental leader, and it eloquently confirms the 5 years and millions of hours that people of every kind has put into this fight. We're still awfully sad about Keystone South and are well aware that the next president could undo all of this, but this is a day of celebration. Unquote. The words of Bill McKibben, co-founder of 350.org. Coming up next on Political Perspectives, we hear an excerpt from Radio EcoShock on the current climate catastrophe in Indonesia, which hasn't made the front page. Massive fires have been burning in Indonesia, resulting in the release of more greenhouse gases than the entire annual emissions of highly industrialized Germany. Here's Radio EcoShock with host Alex Smith.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Over the past few weeks, planet Earth has experienced a severe climate crisis. It hasn't even made the front page of newspapers or the top story on TV news. This catastrophe will hasten warming of oceans and land, adding to rising seas, threaten more species with extinction, and it will change our whole view of environmental action and what we need to do to save the climate. Massive fires have been burning in Indonesia. In satellite images, large parts of that country and Malaysia and Singapore are buried under smoke. Red dots of fires and hot spots want to cover the whole map of the islands. In a few minutes, I'm going to bring you interviews from two very informed people. We get a report directly from the scene with Dr. Daniel Muriadarso at the Center for International Forestry Research in Bogor, Indonesia. Then I'll thrash through this crisis with one of the long-standing reporters on tropical forests, Bonga Bay founder Rhett Butler. But first, we need to talk. These are not common forest fires, as experienced in Western North America, as bad as those were. For one thing, unless climate change prevents it, Western forests are expected to grow back, recapturing some of the carbon. Indonesian tropical forests are not expected to return. they're being replaced with either palm oil plantations or just waste land. At least half of the hundreds of major fires in Indonesia are burning peat, you know, like the peat bales purchased by gardeners, or the peat formerly used in the Middle Ages as fuel. It's a thick layer of very compressed vegetation built up over long ages. About 12% of the land in Southeast Asia is peat swamp forest. 83% of that is in Indonesia. Peat there can be 1 meter deep or 3 feet deep or up to 12 meters or 40 feet deep. And when peat dries out, it begins to emit both carbon dioxide and the more powerful greenhouse gas methane. When peat burns, it releases a mix of toxic dust and gases with grave effects on human health, animal health, and the climate of the world. You can't put out a peat fire with a water bomber or ground crews. The fire goes underground. It smolders and smokes until seasonal rains or snow comes. Some peat fires last for years, resurfacing every year. Tropical peat fires release phenomenal amounts of greenhouse gases. Calculations by the World Resources Institute find that the Indonesian fires over the past 3 months have released more greenhouse gases than the entire annual emissions of highly industrialized Germany. For the past month or so, Indonesia has been emitting more greenhouse gases daily than the entire United States economy. This is a burst of carbon not seen since the last great Indonesian fires in 1997. The Indonesian greenhouse burst throws off all previous calculations of how much carbon we could still burn before crossing the 2-degree unsafe level. It will force a redraw of our models and will create, sooner or later, more swift and unpleasant surprises for all of us in our climate system. The unknowns loom larger. The small number of campaigners who work trying to save tropical forests have been trying to tell us this for years, but they've always been a smaller party among the environmentalists and scientists who struggle to stop the orgy of fossil fuel burning. Now we have to open our minds to a horrible new truth. If humans continue to convert the gigantic biomass of tropical forests and peat bogs into carbon in the sky, it may not matter if you install solar panels on your home or stop flying. The current crisis in Indonesia shows us that a less developed country can create more greenhouse gases than the largest industrialized countries in the world. Think about what that means. One result is that environmental campaigners and the public have to quickly become global citizens rather than nationalists. Let's admit it. Hardly anyone in the Americas and few in Europe know anything about Indonesia. We don't need to know. Our societies are self-contained. We go to work. We hope to buy things. We have our family. Who cares? I know some of you will be surprised to learn Indonesia is the fourth most populous country in the world. There are at least 250 million people spread out over thousands of volcanic islands north of Australia and south of the Philippines. Actually, the population is not spread out very much. In 2012, 141 million Indonesians lived on the single island of Java. That's the real center of the country and of the culture. Periodically, the central government in Jakarta, which is on the island of Java, tries to persuade more people to move out to the less populated islands, like Sumatra or their part of Borneo known as Kalimantan. We'll hear about Kalimantan in our guest interviews. That's where the dense and toxic smoke has covered everything for over 100 days. The Indonesian government considered an evacuation, but hasn't been able to mount it. Kids play in the smoke while hospitals fill up with babies and the elderly. That's another side of this disaster. At least 500,000 Indonesians have been hospitalized due to breathing difficulties and other health problems caused by the smoke. If the Indonesian economy managed to grow at all this year, all that was lost due to the damage from these fires. Indonesians pay now and directly for this crisis. We will all pay, possibly for centuries, for the greenhouse gases released. In newspaper columnist George Monbiot wrote this week, the fires in Indonesia are, quote, the greatest environmental disaster of the 21st century so far. We've reached one of the top forestry scientists in Indonesia. Dr. Daniel Murdiarso is senior scientist at the Center for Forestry Research, or CFOR. He's led Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports. He has served as Deputy Minister of the Environment for the Government of Indonesia. Dr. Murdi Arso, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, how are you?
Very good, and I'm pleased to talk with you. Could you start by just describing the fire and smoke situation in Indonesia this year? Sort of how many fires are there or hotspots, and where are they located?
Well, this year fire is quite extensive. It spread over the island of Sumatra. There are three big provinces like Riau, Jambi, and South Sumatra. They're all blanketed by smoke these days. The hotspots ranging between 200 to 400 points in the past 3 months or so, and fire is still raging as we speak. And in Kalimantan, part of the Borneo island, the number of hotspots is more or less the same, but picking up the highest about 2 weeks ago, about 400 hotspots in west and central Kalimantan.
Is the driving force behind the fires agricultural clearing, forestry operations, or clearing for palm oil plantations?
Well, it's a mix of everything, small and large. But we hardly seen any evidence of logging these days. So it's unlike the 1997 fire was following the logging operation. But these days, it's mainly bush and secondary vegetation clear up for agriculture or plantations. Yeah, the same thing happened in both Sumatra and Kalimantan.
Indonesia is the world's largest exporter of palm oil, I understand. So who is buying it, and what are they using it for?
Well, the most importer of CPO, the crude palm oil, these days is China and India and also Europe and the U.S. Depending on these countries, the way palm oil is used is ranging from cosmetic kind of stuff is household use and cooking oil, edible oil, but also for biofuel. So these countries use the oil palm, which is very productive in terms of yield in per unit area compared with other vegetative or biofuel produced in Europe or in the U.S.
Yes, I think even the Dutch were burning palm oil in power plants as a green fuel in the sense that it can be replanted and regrown. I want to ask you about climate change now. Forest fires and peat fires have been an annual occurrence for Indonesia, at least since the previous great El Nino year of 1997-98. How does this outbreak compare to recent years and to that 97-98 fire season?
Well, yes, as I said, the 1997 fire, it was also El Nino year, very strong one, prolonged. And at the same time, the conversion of tropical forests was taking place. So following the logging fire happened and then the extension of agricultural land. But this year, in the past few years, it's mainly bush and secondary forest kind of fire. It's hard to see any logging operation at the moment.
The Western press is reporting that with these fires, greenhouse emissions from Indonesia this year have now surpassed those of the entire U.S. economy. Do you find that credible, and what calculations of emissions do you have?
Well, we have not finished our estimate yet, because it's hard to see the precise area burn. As the smoke is still blanketing the area, you cannot see it with Landsat kind of product. You can guess with MODIS or even lower resolution, but it's quite crude. So the most important component to estimate emission is really the emission factor of this material burn, and then the area. And if it's involved, and it is the case involving peatland, then you need to know the depth of peat burn. So that's a very crucial number to get a better estimate of emission.
I think this peat fire angle is very important. I'm wondering if you could explain the mechanism of how and why peat is burning, and maybe give us an idea of the volume of peat that could eventually burn in Indonesia.
Right. Well, once it is exposed, when the peat swamp forest is cut down, and then people start to drain it for agricultural activities. Then the peat are exposed and oxidized and dried out, and is prone to fire. So even without fire, draining peat land is also emitting greenhouse gases. But if it is extensive, then it is very sensitive to fire. The first 30 centimeters kind of layer is very sensitive to it, but it does not mean that you can only burn the first few centimeter surface, but it can go deep down in the peat if it is dry enough. That's why we have smoldering instead of raging fire. It's very lack of oxygen, so you have a lot of smoke in the peat fires.
And I've seen that they can go on for years, and they're very difficult to put out. I'm wondering, in your opinion, are the Indonesian peat fires perhaps a preview of what could happen in the Arctic as it warms and peat thaws there in the far north?
Well, the process is a bit different, because in releasing greenhouse gases in peatland, you need to dry it out and burn. But in the Arctic permafrost, you only need to warm it up. Yes, if the emission of greenhouse gases elsewhere warm the atmosphere up, then the permafrost will be thawed. And that's the time when you release methane, which is more disastrous than CO2. It's got 25 times global warming potential than carbon dioxide.
Let's talk about public health. What are the smoke conditions in Indonesia now? You were just in Jakarta. Is it smoky there?
Well, we are in Bogor, even better here, but I was in the spot 2 weeks ago. This is very, very detrimental. You can see a lot of kids playing around with no awareness about the danger of this haze and smoke, a toxic one. Although they are out of school, but still people are roaming around the city. And I think the worst impact of haze and smoke these days is the health, instead of, well, of course, greenhouse gas emission, but the impact to human health is appalling. It's about 43 million people exposed to haze these days, and half a million are affected with these respiratory problems. So I think if you turn that numbers into monetary term, the economic loss is substantial.
Can we expect excess deaths could result from the smoke this year?
Well, there are casualties, cases in Riau province, in South Sumatra. I think the death toll is 10 at the moment. And young baby and elderly people are very vulnerable to diseases driven by smoke.
How far has the smoke spread in Southeast Asia? What's happening in Malaysia and Singapore?
Well, it's not much reported. I think they are affected these days, but not like 1997. It was started in July, and the easterly wind affects Singapore very badly. Now it's happening a bit later, so the wind direction is different with 1997-98 fires. I think the disruption of lights and everything is less than the 1997 fires.
This is Radio EcoShock from Bogor, Indonesia. Our guest is forest expert Daniel Murdiarso. What is the Indonesian president, known as Jokowi, saying about this, and what government solutions are being offered, Daniel?
Well, as far as we hear now, the permits to open up the peatland is being reviewed. I think the government will have a very tough measure in terms of issuing new permits in developing peatland especially. They are aware that this is a big mistake to give permits to manage peatland, which is quite sensitive to drought and fire.
What are the challenges at the local level to reducing or ending these annual fires?
I think the hard part of it, if the central government has this kind of policy, then it is not followed by the local government. That's very hard to have this realized. The way I see it, what's happened in the region, it seems that there is no significant move from the local government whatsoever compare with what the central government is trying to help out. But it is really very much depend on how the local government reacted and responds to this call.
Daniel, do you think this problem is manageable, or will Indonesia continue to be one of the world's top emitters of greenhouse gases?
It's a hard question. it's happening year after year, even in less strong El Nino years, it's also happened. I think this decentralized governance issue is very crucial here to try to help out how this issue is going to be solved in the future. Strong government in the central is not enough if there is no response from the local government, business people who deals with the local government, etc. So it's very complicated processes with regard to economic, the political economy, even local political economy.
Do you think this year's burst of greenhouse gas emissions from Indonesia will be raised at the Paris climate talks in December? And if so, is there a role for the international community?
Well, this year, most countries are submitting their what is called INDC. This is the intended national determined contribution in terms of mitigating climate change, including reducing emission. And I'm a bit disappointed that the issue of haze and fire is not mentioned in the Indonesian INDC. So, yeah, it's hard to predict what's going to happen in the next round of negotiation, because one single fire like this is really off scale all the prediction about emission reduction and outnumbered all those emission estimates from every sectors.
You know, I'm thinking about Paris, and I'm wondering if there was some sort of international funding mechanism to reduce carbon, however that might work, perhaps that would help local governments make better decisions, because there would actually be a bit of money for not clearing out the peat.
Yeah, well, the Green Climate Fund is been discussed and pledged, but it's only promise. Countries longing to see this to be realized in Paris with a new agreement for towards 2020 and beyond. So I think, as I mentioned earlier, the realization is very much at the central government level, and I think it's timely to propagate this message about the potential of local government to get involved in this process.
Please tell us about the Center for International Forestry Research, where you are, what it does, and the resources that it offers.
Okay, well, C4 is one of the 15 CGIAR centers, the Consultative Group of International Agricultural Research, and we are specializing on forestry, landscape, and people depending on forests and across the tropics. We work in three different kind of portfolio dealing with governance of forests, livelihood and forests, and forests and environment. So we basically work mainly on the policy issues and to some extent also on the biophysical aspect of it. We've been supported by a number of countries with an annual budget of about $50 million a year. And what we do is really providing credible information about those issues related to forests and forest people. And hopefully this will be useful for government and community at large to make their decision, planning, etc.
Is there anything I've missed that you would like to tell our listeners?
Yes, I think this time around with regard to fire is very much a kind of waking up bell to deal with forest and land fire in different way, because usually people are talking about firefighting when it happens, but maybe it's very strategic now to think about fire prevention. So this should be a long-run kind of plan so that we are not surprised if things happen like this every time.
You know, it might interest you to know that we had massive fires in Western North America, and in the village where I live, we had to take in 250 fire refugees some of whom lost their homes. It was smoky for several weeks. We couldn't really go outside. So I have a fair feeling for what's happening in Indonesia as well.
Yeah, well, it's terrible, terrible. I was there 2 weeks ago in Palangkaraya, the capital of central Kalimantan. It's so bad. And I was only 5 days there. They've been exposed to a situation like this for more than 100 days. So government are trying to rescue them out. But again, the area which is safe is not ready, and it's a lot of problem too. So it's difficult to cope with this difficult situation in a relatively short period. So as I said, prevention is very crucial.
We've been speaking with Dr. Daniel Murdiarso, the internationally known Indonesian forest expert. He's currently the senior scientist at the Center for Forestry Research, located in Bogor, Indonesia. Dr. Murdiarso, thank you so much for sharing your valuable time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. All the best.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
Cable Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the first CMJ College Day on Tour, Saturday, November 7th at Holocene in Portland. College Day aims to fill a day with great programming and speakers from and related to college and non-commercial radio, allowing both new and experienced voices from the radio world to talk about the issues that matter most to them. At this all-ages event, there will be live music, innovative workshops, presentations, and interviews with key members of the music and radio world from the Pacific Northwest and beyond. Again, that's College Day on Tour, Saturday, November 7th at Holocene, 1001 Southeast Morrison Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 9:59 a.m. Coming up at 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. Followed at 10:15 with Flashpoints. At 11, it's The Incomparable Radio Zine, featuring Intersections with your host, Sarika Mehta, and a little bit from the Siren Nation Festival of Women's Visual Arts, Spoken Arts, and Music. And thanks to all the KBOO members for your generous support, and those who have not yet managed to become members of the KBOO Foundation can remedy their oversight at kboo.fm. Click where it says donate today. And now, stay tuned for Air Cascadia.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Friday,